Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, C.A. My guest today is the distinguished American scholar and author, James McGregor Burns. His books have garnered both the National Book Award and the Pulitzer Prize, and he is especially noted for his groundbreaking contributions to our understanding of leadership. So a conversation with James McGregor Burns is an excellent opportunity for us to probe three vital subjects. What's the state of American presidential leadership at the start of the 21st century? And what are the challenges to leadership in American society at large, and how might they be met? And finally this, will the 21st century, with its obvious emphasis on globalization and cultural diversity, lead to changes in our understanding of leadership and leadership theory? Jim Burns, thank you so much for being with us today on Dialogue. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, George.
Jim, I want to go back in time to come up to the present and future. Go back to 1978 and your groundbreaking book, Leadership. You gave us a new vocabulary for leadership in that book, transactional and transformational, which we'll get to in just a moment. But I think you did something very early in that book that I found fundamental to everything else, and that's to distinguish between the power wielder and the leader. Would you remind us of what that distinction is, Jim?
Well, the power wielder, as the term indicates, is a person who mainly rules through power. And there's a short word for that compared to leader, the ruler. To me, the leader is somebody who obviously has to use power in governing a people, but he or she does it in terms of overriding values. Mm-hmm. And I know we hear a lot about values and it gets sort of trivialized at times, but when I talk about values, I mean the great values that inform a nation.
Things that go to the soul of a people, perhaps.
Yes, and incidentally, no one has reached that as well as Woodrow Wilson, who understood something beyond the usual sort of traits of a people or the traits of a leader to get to what is a leader really willing to fight for and to fight for and fight for and finally breakthrough.
That's an excellent insight, Jim, for us to look at a lot of presidencies. When you speak of Woodrow Wilson in that way, I get the sense you're speaking especially of your notion of transforming leadership, of a president, in this case, who can look into the soul and history of a people and then elevate us. Is that right?
Exactly.
Who would be, and he would be your idea of a transforming president in the 20th century?
Yes, except he failed in the end to do the thing that he most wanted to do, which was to have the United States join the League of Nations. But he tried so hard to do that. He fought for it, and in effect he died for it, literally, that 20 years later, the memory of this man and his effort and what we failed to do, I think was partly responsible for us taking the lead in setting up the United Nations.
So a transforming leader who fights the big battles can win even posthumously, in a sense.
Yes, that's a good point and absolutely right for many others besides Wilson.
And the important point I think also you're making, Jim, is that a transforming leader is willing to fight those battles no matter what the cost.
Yes, willing to face conflict. And so many politicians shrink from conflict. It's always impressive to see a man who stands up and says, I believe in this, and I'm going to fight for it.
Those politicians, Jim, who shrink from conflict, as you put it, and I think you outline in all your books that the willingness to face conflict, have convictions, and have courage are the essential components of transformational leadership. But those who shrink from conflict, can they lead on a lower level, perhaps the transactional level?
Well, I do make this distinction between the transactional and the transformational, and they sort of explain themselves, those terms. The transactional leader is the one we most often see. It's the leader, the politician who, or the businessman, or the father, or the spouse, who makes deals, who negotiates, who reciprocates, and who goes through life, and this is a very crucial role, in that way, sort of transacting the business of the day, a give and take, and all that. That is what most of us do most of the time. That's what most politicians do most of the time. But there comes a time in the lives, our own lives, and perhaps in the life of our community, but particularly in the life of a nation, when more is needed than simply making deals, making exchanges, negotiating. You have to get back to what we were talking about earlier. You've got to take a stand and fight for it. And if you're a successful transforming leader, then there are changes all through society as a result of the position you took.
Well, you put me in mind of Washington,
yes,
of Lincoln, of FDR. But I would think you might agree with me, Jim, most of our presidents, most of our leaders have been transactionalists, I would think.
Yes. First of all, because it's partly in the nature of the American people. We are sort of negotiators, get along, go along people, which is good most of the time. But also because it's very difficult to be a transforming leader. It's very dangerous.
Right.
And of course, again, we go back to Wilson, because it's rather interesting looking back on Wilson, who fought the great fight for what he believed in, how he is often referred to by historians as a failure.
Yes, indeed.
He was not a failure. He, first of all, he was very effective in his early presidency. But again, he made the fight, and making the fight is the first step in a great battle.
How would you react to this critique, Jim Burns, this kind of devil's advocacy thought? If someone were to say to you, Jim, this is all well and good, these great visionary leaders, these transformers have been remarkable people, but can't that get a society into trouble? Aren't you better off with transactionalists who just sort of play the game, broker support, get things done, but don't push us to the edge?
Well, I think if someone put the point as well as you had just done, I would be quite impressed by it. But my answer would be that, yes, it is dangerous, but that's why I bring values into this so strongly. They have to be tested, the great leaders, by a set system of values. And this nation has values. And I'm talking not about ethics and virtues, although those are important. I'm talking about the great values that guide a country. And a lot of people feel that's just talk. But as I've studied history, and you may know with your interest in history, I did three volumes in American history, looking at this question, to what extent did the American people pursue a set of values through these 200 years or so? And they did.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that, they did a kind of a prioritizing of values. It's easy, you know, to throw around these great words like freedom and equality and liberty and security and so on. The important thing is what comes first.
Right.
And I think they know what comes first. It's right in all the great documents. It's liberty. So getting back to your question, any president who violated the great elements of liberty would automatically, I hope, be rejected by the American people.
But by the same token, any president such as Lincoln who would take that notion and expand it would be capable of visionary leadership and transform us. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And that's what happened with Lincoln. You know, he moved a lot during the Civil War from just being, again, a kind of a transactional leader.
Right.
He became a transformational.
Well, this is an important point in itself, Jim. On the spectrum of transaction to transformational, are there midpoints? Can a president or any leader act in one style or another as a combination of them, perhaps?
Yes, they're all combinations. Roosevelt's the classic case. I wrote a book called Roosevelt, the Lion and the Fox, because
right.
that Machiavellian thought, which I stole from him, summarizes my view of Roosevelt, that he was very much the transformational leader, and he was very much the transactional leader. And of course, he had learned some lessons from Wilson, for whom he worked during World War I, and saw close up. And Roosevelt so skillfully combined those two qualities. And there are degrees. There are degrees of transactional leader. You can just be an absolute day-to-day broker.
I mean,
that's all you do. Or you can use your transactional ability to bring about change.
Right.
And there are degrees of transformational leadership as well.
Jim, this talk of presidents and lions and foxes and brokers and visionaries, I think brings us very ably and very well to your current book. It's Dead Center, which you wrote with Georgia Sorensen. And it is a critique, I must say a very detailed critique, of the present incumbent, Bill Clinton.
Yes.
Who, my reading of the book, Jim, is that you take him to task quite seriously here for failing on the transformational scale. Is that right?
Yes, that's true. I'd like to make that a little softer because we rather admire his personal qualities. And this is sort of a new approach because usually people attack him for his personal failings and like him as a politician, including, it seems, the majority of the American people, and others do the opposite. We found him very impressive close up when we talked with him. It was under very difficult circumstances in 1992, where he might have said, we were in a campaign car, squeezed in, not into a great limousine.
But going to Paul's Church, I think.
Yeah, sort of a decoy car, I think. And we were practically sitting on top of each other, he and Georgia Sorensen and I. And it was a difficult moment in the campaign, and I could imagine he'd say, how the devil am I, and, you know, have to spend time with these two scholars. No, he was exceedingly not only pleasant, but most important, he was responding brilliantly to the questions we raised, which were questions about transformational leadership.
I was struck by that as I read the book, but is the essence of your critique that this president, with all of his great personal qualities and political skill, was capable of a transformational leadership he well understood, but chose to act in a transactional manner perhaps too often? Is that the essence of your charge against the presidency?
Yes, and not only chose to, but in a sense went to school in it because he had been in and a leader of the Democratic Leadership Council,
right,
which preaches centrism. If you're a centrist, you're a transactional leader. That's what centrists do. And it was not just by chance that he follow that course, that strategy. It was because he believed in it.
Well, what would you say to this, Jim, if someone were to say to you, well, Jim Burns, that's well and good, but that's all he could get away with. That's all you could do in America at the close of the 20th century was lead from the center, lead as a transactionalist.
I would say that to a certain extent that's true because we have a system, a constitutional system of checks and balances, which means that you constantly have to negotiate with the House, the Senate, even with the judges and with the states. But the greatness of the great presidents has been that they have risen above that.
Mm-hmm.
They've done their negotiating and so on, as in the case of Wilson, who was very skillful at that. But there comes a time when you have to rise above it. That was true of Abraham Lincoln. It was true of Wilson. It was true of Roosevelt when he was so frustrated by the checks and balances that he, you know, the Supreme Court was striking down his legislation and so on, that he took a much stronger position and tried to transform certain aspects of the American system.
Mm.
It's a dangerous game, George. There's no question about it. Wilson shows that. But at times it has to be done.
Jim, there's lots to talk to you about on this. Let me take a moment from our conversation, though, just to remind viewers that this is Dialogue at the Woodrow Wilson Center, and I'm George C.A. My guest is the distinguished Pulitzer Prize-winning historian James McGregor Burns. Our subject is leadership. Jim, if you don't mind, I'd like to stay a bit longer on the Clinton presidency, because the subtitle of this book, Dead Center, talks about the perils of moderation. And maybe that's the next question, Jim. Where is the danger in a transactional presidency that didn't become a transformational one?
The danger is that government does not make much progress. It does not change itself compared to the enormous changes that are taking place outside of government. We live in a time of relentless and titanic change in technology, science, business, entertainment, media, agriculture, war, and the like. And watching those changes, as I do, as we all do, and looking at the feeble, slow effort of government to deal with those changes, to me, indicates the need for very strong, vigorous leadership.
That gives me two immediate thoughts, Jim. First is that you seem to be talking about Bill Gates in the private sector and his ilk. The people,
yes.
The private sector leadership that now has control of technology and wealth is, if I understand you, moving ahead faster than the government.
Yes.
But in defense of the government, isn't it difficult to really get a sense of what this all means? I mean, to react transformationally at a point where we may not understand what we're faced with fully.
Well, I don't think it's hard to understand the problems. And what most worries me is that, well, two things. One is we have no control, very little control about those changes outside of government. We have some control about changes in government. But the other thing is we don't, George, we don't solve our problems. I've lived a pretty long life, and from the beginning of the New Deal, when these problems were dramatized, until today's paper, these problems of health and jobs and housing and all the rest, it's such a well-known list, it's mm-hmm. kind of boring to go through it.
Would you put education in there?
And of course, education above all. Those go on, and they're deeply rooted in the structure. They're terribly hard to deal with, and only a strong push from inside government will ever help solve those problems.
So what you're saying is we're tinkering and managing rather than leading and changing in these areas.
Well said.
And that's what's needed.
Yes.
Jim, let me challenge you on that in a moment with this question at this moment. Bill Bradley ran a primary campaign that many thought was oriented to big ideas, and I think big ideas is at the essence of transformational leadership. He got nowhere. Is it at some level a question also of the appetite for change within the body politic, that there has to be an audience, if you will, for the transforming leadership that's ready to do it?
Yes, of course. And we live in good times and we're complacent and happy, so it makes it very difficult for a politician to take a strong line. But some presidents have been able to do it.
In good times?
In good times. And the classic example is Theodore Roosevelt, Wilson's mortal enemy, and vice versa. Theodore Roosevelt did not have a depression on his hands. He had good times. He did not have a war. He would have loved to have had a war, but he didn't have a war as president. He brought about amazing changes through sheer leadership, intensity, conviction, continuity, follow through, pushing, pushing, pushing. So he's given presidents an example of what you can do without a crisis.
And what do you think Bill Clinton could have done with the unprecedented power and prosperity that we had for the last 8 years?
Well, I think he could have simply taken a much stronger line ideologically. And a good example of this is, let's take the tax situation. He typically would deal with the tax situation in terms of balancing the budget. In my view, in terms of values, the great problem with our tax structure is the sheer inequity, the unfairness of our tax system. He's very good, Clinton, at protecting it. I mean, he vetoes the estate tax reduction or abolition and so on. But he is not very good at rallying the people behind a moral issue, which is of fairness, mm-hmm. of equality.
You think he could have done that in the face of the conservative challenge he faced?
I think it would have made him much more successful if he had done that, if he had mobilized people behind his ideas of equality instead of just balancing the budget, even though it's nice to have a balanced mm-hmm. budget.
You know, one thing to enter into our conversation also at this point is that centrism as a philosophy is now the way of the West. You have Tony Blair in Britain, mm-hmm. Gerhard Schroeder in Germany following the Clinton model. So do you think this is a long-standing trend? Because the current election cycle sort of suggests it might be.
It will be a long-standing thing until a real economic crisis. And that would be the test of a lot of what we're talking about here, not these good times, as you say. It's what happens when we have 10 million, well, I'm young enough to have been through the crisis of the 1930s. I knew what it was like when something like that happened. I had one uncle who shot himself in the Depression, another who was traumatized, he never worked again, and many other stories I could tell about the actual impact of a depression on a family and a community. when we get into a situation like that again, and we may not, maybe we've got prosperity forever, I hope so, but if we ever get into that situation, that will be a test of a lot of what we're talking about today.
Well, I think that's a very good point. And if and probably when that kind of challenge comes, it's going to put an emphasis on something else you're concerned about. And that I call popular leadership, because the question can be asked, we've been talking about elites and presidents and so forth, but I think watching us or thinking about this would say, well, what about leadership at the community level? Now, that's a topic you've been giving some attention to as well, isn't it?
Yes, that's why I'm calling this new book Transforming People, in both senses there. Now, as a literary man yourself, and I'm sure you picked that up, that how you transform people, but people transforming. And we mean it in both ways. And what I'm trying to get to in this new book is exactly what you're reaching for. What is this people to begin with? You know, all these references to government by the people and so on. Who are the people? And to my mind, the people are the underprivileged. It's the great mass, and I know it's an old oration and so on, but I happen to believe in it. It's the submerged people. It's the desperate people who are forgotten decade after decade, who are talked about, who are talked to, who are asked to vote for people, and they do it, and nothing fundamentally happens in that school in Harlem. And I know that school in Harlem, and nothing happens there.
And what you want to see happen is for people in those circumstances to have their own voice. Is that a focus of the Academy for Leadership at the University of Maryland, that kind of training and education for leadership?
Very much so. Again, because we think there's a big moral, if you wish, a spiritual dimension to this aspect of leadership.
Indeed, there is. Speaking of spiritual dimensions, Jim Burns, brings me to a point in our conversation that I've long anticipated, because it's very fashionable today to speak about being in the 21st century, at the cusp of all kinds of new changes. And in point of fact, the new changes are here. The world is getting globalized. We are in a situation in which cultures are coming forth, and cultural diversity is a very big issue. What's your thinking about that? Is that going to change the nature of what we think of as leadership?
Well, I have very strong feelings about that, because speaking of diversity, of which there is an enormous amount, there is one great unity. It's written down, and very few people refer to it, and I'm happy to have the opportunity to. It's called the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written largely by my personal hero, heroine, Eleanor Roosevelt. And when people say to me, well, there may be national values you can appeal to, but there are no global values, I say to them, look at that declaration. It's not just a bunch of great words. It is page after page of detail, and it puts liberty first, and then equality and justice. So if we could go back to that, I think there is, again, a spiritual dimension to that that might relate to the whole globe.
When we speak of the spiritual dimension, and when we speak of going back to documents like that, and the men and women will be leading societies in the 21st century, is your essential point, Jim Burns, that they're going to have to think on this global scale, that I don't want to predict the end of the nation state or anything approximating that quite yet, but that we're going to have to speak, think and act in a much broader kind of compass?
Absolutely, and that's why I say that there is a basis to do it. I mean, we're all urged to be global and to think globally, but it's very hard to think globally, but we have a basis for thinking.
And will the transforming leaders make us aware of that basis? Because I think, and I think you point this out in all your books, educating the populace as you lead them has to be a central aspect of transforming leadership.
Yes, that's such a crucial dimension, George. The and I think of, again, Woodrow Wilson, but particularly Roosevelt. He said that he was going to shift from Dr. New Deal to Dr. Win the War. He never really did. He kept being Dr. New Deal during Win the War period. But he proclaimed the four freedoms that are another great guide, just very succinct. And he also, what we call the Economic Bill of Rights, which served as a guide to this country and to the world for years, can serve for decades after Roosevelt died.
Jim Burns, just as I expected, this has been an extremely enriching conversation for me, and I think for all watching. I'd like to conclude it by drawing on your considerable skills as a political scientist, because I know that on this question of leadership, presidential leadership in particular, you've been calling recently for a presidential commission or a study of what this is all about and what it might mean for the 21st century. I guess I could pose the question almost critically. Jim Burns, what would one more commission add to our understanding of this subject? There have been commissions throughout our history, as you know, most of them to perhaps little effect. But what would you expect of a commission on the presidency?
Well, George, I worked for the Hoover Commission years ago, and it did a pretty good job in its restricted realm, so they can do some good. And I think a future commission could. And let me give you one example of what a presidential commission, or a national commission, perhaps, could do. Take the most frightening moment in my life and yours, I expect, which was the Cuba Missile Crisis, with the Soviet ships on the way to Cuba and all that familiar story. And for several days, there was this continuing debate in the Kennedy Oval Office. It was not Kennedy sitting there pondering war or peace. It was a group of people struggling with this question. And I think it was because it was a collective decision of that sort, we came out the right way. I would like to see a presidential commission that might recommend a constitutionally based commission just on foreign policy that would always be there to advise of the president that he would or she would have to consult, and at least make this a collective decision, because the idea of one man with his finger on that trigger is something that we cannot tolerate.
You know, Jim, as I would have expected with that reference to history, you make this very vivid for me, because I remember, as we all do, those awful days in 62. And I think with that answer, you make me very aware of what a meaningful commission could do on the presidency. And so, Jim Burns, for yet one more great original idea, let me thank you very much for sharing it with us and for being with us on Dialogue today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jim. You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was James McGregor Burns. I'm George Liston CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed. Our technical director is John Tyler. And our production assistant is Andrea Bertone. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.